Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Ukraine Calling. I'm Marko Suprin for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We have a roundup of the weekly news for you, a feature interview with Taras Kuzyo about his new book, Putin's War Against Ukraine, a cultural section, and of course, some music. But first, as always, the news. The intensity of fighting between the Russian occupation army and their proxies and the Ukrainian army has not changed significantly over the last week. There were reports about an increase in hostilities, usually followed by information that the situation stabilized. On September 25, Russian proxy forces reportedly shelled residential areas of the town of Mariinka in the Donetsk region. 3 days later, on September 28, shelling of residential areas continued in the towns of Mariinka and Zhuvanka, again in the Donetsk region. One civilian was wounded. Over the last week, three Ukrainian servicemen were killed in action and four were wounded. There was a huge explosion at an ammunition depot near Kalinivka, Vinnytsia Oblast, almost 250 kilometers west of Kyiv. Late in the evening on Tuesday, September the 26th, apparently a fire set off explosions from the weapons stored in the depot, and as a result, about 30,000 people had to be evacuated from the surrounding area. As a safety precaution, many villages in the area were cut off from electricity and gas, there were transport disruptions, and the airspace above the area was closed off for several days. The extent of the property damage is not yet known. A similar large explosion occurred in March at a depot in the Kharkiv Oblast in eastern Ukraine. Many top Ukrainian officials, including President Poroshenko, have cited the event as sabotage. However, there is no doubt that the loss of a large ammunition depot will result in a heavy blow to Ukraine's military capabilities. A new law in education, which President Poroshenko signed into law this week, and which has been recognized as a big stride forward in reforming the Ukrainian education system, has come under international criticism for its treatment of minority language groups. The law would introduce new curricula, new teaching methods into Ukrainian schools, as well as have an increased emphasis on Ukrainian as the language of education. However, for schools in minority language communities, this would mean that instruction in state schools, from fifth grade onwards, would be in Ukrainian instead of in the minority language, as it has been to date. Minorities in Ukraine have reacted with criticism, and the governments of Hungary and Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, and Greece have expressed their concern about changes to language instruction for minority language groups. The foreign minister of Hungary went so far as to say that Hungary will block all further steps of Ukraine's European integration process in the European Union due to the language in schools issue. The Ukrainian government has defended its legislation. According to Ukrainian legislators, the law is the basis for comprehensive educational reform, which will improve education and bring it in line with EU standards. Foreign Minister Klimkin stated that he saw using and learning Ukrainian as important and as a national security issue. He said that Ukraine must protect both Ukrainian as well as the language of national minorities. President Poroshenko insisted that we could not but strengthen the role of Ukrainian in education. There are plans to continue consultations with international partners concerning the controversial article in the law. Foreign Minister Klimkin and Education Minister Lilia Hrinevich are to meet with EU officials to discuss the language issues raised by the new legislation and with the Council of Europe, which will subject the law to expert scrutiny. We'll include a link to this story on our website. Ukraine's President Poroshenko was in Canada September 22nd and 23rd. The president met with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. While economics and peacekeeping missions were talking points of the meeting, a new announcement from Prime Minister Trudeau was that the Canadian government had begun the process of allowing the export of certain weapons to Ukraine. This move was seen as an important continuation of the 2015 deal made by former Prime Minister Stephen Harper and will further coordinate Canadian support with U.S. actions. The deputy head of the Crimean Tatar Majlis, Imli Umerov, has been sentenced to 2 years imprisonment in a penal colony for calling for separatism and calls for action aiming at the violation of Russia's territorial integrity. The sentence that Umerov received is considered dangerous for a 60-year-old who suffers from diabetes and Parkinson's disease. The court ruling handed down was even harsher than that recommended by the prosecutor. Umerov has said that he will appeal the ruling all the way to the European Court of Human Rights. The sentencing of Ilmi Umerov took place the same week that a report was released by the UN Commissioner for Human Rights on abuses in Crimea. The report cites arbitrary arrests and detentions, enforced disappearances, torture, and ill treatment with no accountability taking place in Crimea under Russian occupation. As the Invictus Games wrap up this week, Ukraine has had an excellent first showing. On Sunday, Serhii Turchinsky brought home Ukraine's first ever Invictus medal by winning bronze in men's IF4 shot put. And the first gold was won by team captain Oleksandr Pisarenko for indoor rowing. As of September 27th, Ukraine's official total medal count stood at 7. With us today is a guest from formerly the UK, but now also a wanderer of the world, Taras Kuzio. Taras Kuzio received his Bachelor of Arts in Economics from the University of Sussex, a Master's of Arts in Area Studies, the USSR and Eastern Europe, from the University of London, and a PhD in Political Science from the University of Birmingham, England. Currently, he is a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations, the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Washington, D.C. He has held positions at the University of Alberta, George Washington University, University of Toronto, and Chief of Mission to the NATO Information and Documentation Office in Kyiv, Ukraine. Taras Kuzio is the author and editor of 17 books, including, with Paul Danieri, The Sources of Russia's Great Power Politics, Ukraine and the Challenge to the European Order, coming out in 2018. What we're going to be talking about today is the book that came out in 2017 called Putin's War Against Ukraine, Revolution, Nationalism, and Crime. Also, a book called Ukraine, Democratization, Corruption, and the New Russian Imperialism in 2015, From Kuchmagate to the Orange Revolution in 2009, and Theoretical and Comparative Perspectives on Nationalism from 2007. He is the author of 5 think tank monographs, including The Crimea, Europe's Next Flashpoint from 2010. Taras Kuzio is also the author of 38 book chapters and 100 scholarly articles on Ukrainian and post-communist politics, democratic transitions, color revolutions, nationalism, and European studies. He has been the guest editor of 10 academic journals, Communist and Post-Communist Studies, East European Politics and Society, Nationalities Papers, the Journal of Communist Studies and Transition Politics, and the Problems of Post-Communism. Taras, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
So the new book called Putin's War Against Ukraine, Revolution, Nationalism, and Crime. Tell us a little bit about how you came about with the title and what were some of the thoughts that you had in bringing this book to light?
Well, it's interesting history because back in about 2012, I was discussing the problem of the lack of English language sources in the West on the Donbass. Party regions, etc. Then, of course, Viktor Yanukovych was Ukraine's president. But the whole area of the party regions as a political machine, it was Ukraine's only ever political machine in this American terminology. And the whole history and politics and economics of the Donbass is something that really had not been studied, including, for example, in Ukrainian studies. I mean, it was kind of beyond the pale, as it were. So we launched a project, and this project was funded by the US-based Ukrainian Studies Fund, led by Roman Prosik and Bogdan Witwicki. Little did we know where this project was going to take us, thanks to a man to the north who runs a country to the northeast of Ukraine. So the project began in September 2013. It was initially to be a 3-year research project on the Donbass, but of course, events overtook us, right?
So the book was actually planned before the war started.
Well, a book on the more on the Donbass, mm-hmm. shall we say, on the Donbass within Ukrainian politics and maybe a little bit of history. But of course, the Euromaidan happened. Then, of course, Russia launched military aggression against Ukraine. So what was a narrower research project became a wider research project, and there were many spin-offs of that. Besides the book, there's been many sort of, you know, media, op-ed, and academic articles dealing with party regions, Donbass, crime and corruption, which is a big part of that whole area. I mean, one aspect of the book, one chapter of the book deals with criminality and corruption in the Donbass. It's an area that, again, never featured in Ukrainian studies. It was covered in Russian studies more, you know, the sort of the emergence of mafias in the 90s and organized crime in Russia in the 90s, but not really in Ukrainian studies. But you can't talk about the Donbass unless you also talk about criminality. So that, and especially in a region of the world where Vladimir Putin weaponizes everything, including organized crime.
Do spend a lot of time on the party of regions. And I'm wondering that connection between the nexus between mafia politics and what the party of regions tried to establish in Ukraine. Can you comment on the nature of that construct?
Well, the Donbass was the only region of Ukraine where where different clans were forced or pressured or whatever to combine into one super clan. That didn't happen in, for example, Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, and elsewhere. There was, to this day, there are still competing groups. So in the Donbass, they were successful in combining these after a very brutal civil war that happened in Donetsk and Luhansk between the mid-80s and about the mid-90s, where many people were killed. The areas of Ukraine where you had the fiercest criminal warfare was Donetsk, Odessa, and Crimea. Odessa has historically been corrupt. Crimea, not surprising, because of the tourism and everything else there, and Russian troops and stuff. But Donetsk is a place where you cannot simply divorce local politics from criminality. And what you have is a nexus between law enforcement, state officials, regional politics, and organized crime. And, of course, once the civil war was won by one side, which was the Akhmetov Yanukovych side, by 96 or so, after a very famous explosion in a football stadium in Donetsk, where the big godfather of Ukraine, Alek the Greek, was his criminal nickname, was blown to bits, literally. Akhmetov arrived half an hour late for the football game. There was obviously bad traffic at that time in Donetsk, and he took over. And then him and Yanukovych basically emerged as a pair. He would do business, and Yanukovych would provide the political krisha, the political protection, as it were. And then by 2000-2001, they had managed to bang everybody's heads together to create this super Donetsk clan, which then created the Party of Regions. And so the guys who were on the streets shooting people then, of course, began to buy very expensive suits, began to launder their money, began to try to be respectable. And so you just cannot divorce it. This is also the only region of Ukraine where literally everything was controlled by one clan. Particularly things like the prosecutor's office, the secret services, the police and everything else, which explains why in early 2014, when the protests began, that this was the region of Ukraine where law enforcement did not intervene to actually suppress those pro-Russian protests, because it just withered away. They were when the Party of Regions disintegrated, so did its control of law enforcement. And then there was no law enforcement in presence. There was a vacuum.
Let me ask you something about in this regard, because a lot of people I speak with often look at the Putin construct as dealing with, like you say, and I think it's an apt analogy, a mafia type of organization. You spend a lot of time with Western policymakers. Do they see the world in this part of the world that way, or is some of their policy decisions based on the assumption that some of this is just normal politics?
No, I think that there's always going to be two faces to Western policymakers, one which is the public diplomatic face, of course, and one which is the kind of face you read in WikiLeaks and what you hear them say to you privately. They have known for a long time in U.S. diplomatic cables, which were leaked to WikiLeaks going back to 2010. Even Russia was already then being described as a mafia state. And under Yanukovych, Ukraine was becoming or had become a mafia state. I think there is a distinction to be made between a country that has a problem of corruption and a country where it's a mafia state, where there are these nexuses, where organized crime is integrated into the nexus of the state. It's a very different situation to just, a problem of corruption, which most countries have, especially in Southern Europe and in Canada and Quebec.
Now, one of the themes in your book is there's a very strong thread to history, a very astute understanding of what's been going on in this part of the world for a long time. Being also of Ukrainian descent, I think that's almost a natural phenomenon. And being now a expert on contemporary Ukraine, is anything we're witnessing from the Kremlin today new?
In many ways, no. But what's surprising is that this has all been missed by Western experts, because they kind of seem to have forgotten their Soviet history, and they've particularly forgotten issues of national identity. The, you know, hybrid war, information war, and these kind of things did not begin in 2014. All of the things that Russia is doing today were done before. Of course, today Russia has greater ability to do those things with the use of modern technology, cyber warfare, internet, social media. That didn't exist in the Soviet Union. But things like undertaking assassinations abroad, the USSR has been doing that since 1926 with Simon Petlura. It didn't begin with Yushchenko and Litvinenko in London. Information war campaigns and hoodwinking people and what was called maskirovka. They've been doing this since the 1930s. Look at how they successfully camouflaged the existence of a famine in Ukraine and bought people like Walter Duranty and others. And also, particularly in the 1970s and 80s, the Soviet Union was very big, you know, on questions of disinformatia, as it was called. And they were quite successful. I mean, they did a massive campaign to convince the world that the CIA invented AIDS. And this is one of their big, you know, they would plant stories in third world developing countries. These would then be picked up by Reuters or whatever. In those days, they couldn't check this information. There's no internet, of course. And then it was replayed. And then it'd be reprinted back in the USSR. So it was like this was the sort of, and, you know, those kind of methods have been adopted today in a more professional and expanded manner by the same people. I mean, Putin was KGB officer and now he's in charge of Russia. But I think what the West Western experts ignore the most on this question is the whole question of Russian attitudes to Ukraine. This area isn't really new. I mean, if you go to Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute or the Canadian Institute of Ukraine Studies or Professor Mogochi in Toronto, they will explain to you these issues. They've been around for a long time. But you know, Western historians of Russia, Western experts on Russia and so-called Eurasian affairs don't really want to deal with issues of national identity. And so there's been a lot of bias written in the West, which downplays the influence of Russian nationalism and exaggerates the influence of Ukrainian nationalism. I mean, to put it very bluntly, if Putin was to wake up tomorrow morning and say, I now recognize Ukraine as a separate people and Ukraine as a sovereign independent country, the war would end the same day.
A lot of people are beginning to see this as that war in reality. And you mentioned in your book about the Russian biker gangs, for example. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this, they're conscripting culture, specifically using culture to control territory and expand their reach? Do you think that, would you agree that they use the agency of culture to further their geopolitical aspirations? And in other words, are we looking at a culture war? And if so, how do you begin to even address that when this culture seems to be divergent with reality, right? You get Lavrov saying that Russia is going to adhere to the principles of equality of people, mutual respect, sovereignty, etc., etc. What do we do?
Well, the first thing that the West has to do, and I think it's understood that now, including even Chancellor Merkel a few years ago, the Russian leaders are serial liars. They don't tell the truth. And that shouldn't surprise us so much, you know. I mean, there was always a big divergence in the Soviet Union between what was in the Constitution and what was said and what was reality. That has continued in some ways in Ukraine in the post-Soviet period, you know. One of the most democratic constitutions in the world was the Stalin Constitution of the 1930s, undertaken at a time of mass crimes against humanity. So this divergence between reality and what is said and written is not new in that mindset. They're used to working in this kind of maskirovka. It's kind of this deceptive lying, telling one thing. And, you know, the problem Putin has is that, yes, he can have influence amongst sections of European and North American society, which are anti-establishment, fed up with politics, angry about immigration, this kind of populist nationalist sentiment. But amongst, I would say, the ruling elites and the policymakers, he's lost the war. I don't think he can win the war. And that's true also with Ukraine, because they're not very flexible on issues of... on the one hand, Russia has... The term is it's weaponized everything. I mean, they are literally weaponizing organized crime, cyber warfare, you name it, they will try to weaponize it in their favor. Even there's even Western reports now of Russia weaponizing cigarette smugglers coming into the Baltic states. Yeah, you can smuggle this from Russia into, say, Latvia or Estonia, but in return for that, you're an unofficial spy for us. And maybe a portion of the proceeds. But on culture, I think that they cannot win. And why can they not win? Because Russian leaders, Russian nationalists approach countries like Ukraine and the West with so much baggage and stereotypes, they don't understand. For example, they didn't understand the American elections, how they were going to work. They really believed that, for example, you know, that Hillary Clinton was really behind the protests in Moscow. They kind of believe these things. They don't understand how these things operate. And in the case of Ukraine, I've joked at seminars given to U.S. policymakers in Washington that the people in the room, U.S. government officials from the State Department and elsewhere, are more knowledgeable about Ukraine than people in Moscow. And that's not surprising. The Russian leaders and Russian intelligence and Russian political technologists have got Ukraine wrong on two major occasions. 2004, they got Ukraine wrong. They were absolutely convinced Yanukovych was going to win, 12% economic growth in 2004. Only the West Ukrainians are going to vote for this American Ukrainian and Ukraine nationalist. They were wrong. And they were wrong in 2014 when they believed that Russian speakers in eastern and southern Ukraine were going to greet with bread and salt Russian soldiers. They were wrong there. So they don't understand the West and they don't understand Ukraine, but they think they do. And that's their major downfall. We, I think, in the West, not us in particular, but policymakers need to be more, less starry-eyed and more kind of understanding of what this regime it consists of. And the regime is, Russian regime is, it's a militocracy, it's been described as, a regime run by the Siloviki, the security forces. It's a regime which is approaching fascism, and it's a mafia state. And that's what Russia is today.
The book, again, is called Putin's War Against Ukraine by Taras Kuzio. It's available in print and on Amazon.com. It is full with very interesting interviews. Taras spent a lot of time clearly on the front interviewing people from Luhansk, and not just pro-Ukrainian, but also, let's just say, pro-Putin people that are part of the effort to bring Ukraine back into Russia's orbit. Taras, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In this digital age, people in Ukraine continue to write, publish, and read books on paper. Award-winning poet-publisher Ivan Malkovich has just released a new anthology of Ukrainian 20th century poetry. It was presented at the Lviv Book Forum earlier in the month. This week, on September 28th, it was finally introduced to Kyiv readers. The event was broadcast live by Ukrainian radio, and a number of musicians performed at the event. Several poets represented in the new anthology who are still alive were present. In Malkovich's words, the collection represents the best of Ukrainian poetry from Chechena to Zhdan. Serhiy Zhdan is a contemporary poet and author from Luhansk who now lives in Kharkiv and is a literary superstar. When he presented his book, Internat, which is about the war in the Donbas in Kyiv on 26 September, the hall of the Budenok Kino, the film building, was overflowing. People flocked to see him like they do for rock concerts. And when seats ran out, they stood or sat in the aisles and even on the stage. After the reading, Zhdan took the time to sign books for everyone waiting in the long lineup. The book is available online, and we'll post links to both books on our website. There's a band in Ternopil called Tik 2. This week, they played a Golden Hits concert in Kyiv. Here's a song from their 2016 album Shuma called Malyuki, which means something like little ones. Enjoy. We'll be right back. We'll be back with even more news, culture, and music. So tune in again next week for a new edition of Ukraine Calling. We'd be happy to receive any feedback from you, so remember to write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Marco Suprin in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.